This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
There are few more remarkable events in world history than the series of military campaigns in which Arab Muslim armies swept through the Middle East, defeating the armies of the two great powers of the ancient world, the Roman Byzantine Empire of the Eastern Mediterranean lands and the Persian Sasanian Empire, which ruled not only the lands of modern Iran, but Iraq as well, their authority stretching far into Central Asia. It's partly the speed of these conquests which impresses. At the time of the death of the Prophet Muhammad in 632 AD, the Muslim community was confined to the Arabian Peninsula, and its control over that was fairly precarious. In the late 630s and early 640s, all that changed. Muslim armies won a series of battles which gave them control over Syria and Iraq before 640, Egypt a year later, and by 650 they had some sort of control over most of Iran, and the last of the Sasanian kings had been killed, where he'd fled, far to the northeast of his domains, on the borders of Central Asia. Further conquests led Muslim armies to North Africa and Spain in the west, Uzbekistan and southern Pakistan in the east. By 720, less than 90 years after Muhammad's death, Muslim rule extended from the Atlantic to the Indus. Yet this military conquest, and fast and widespread as it was, is not the most remarkable feature of this movement. There had been great conquests before. The memory of Alexander the Great was still very much alive in both Greek and Persian cultures, and there were to be others in the future. The ferocious campaigns of Genghis Khan in the 13th century were more wide-ranging and much more brutal than the Arab-Muslim expeditions, and yet their long-term impact on the cultures of the Middle East was almost negligible. What is really impressive about the early Muslim conquests was that they changed the religion, culture, and language of those areas in ways which have lasted down to the present day. Of the lands conquered in this great burst of 7th century activity, all except Israel and Spain and Portugal are still ruled by Muslim elites, and Islam, in one of its many forms, is the dominant religion. And Arabic, only spoken in Arabia and the Syrian deserts in the 6th century, and hardly written even there, is the dominant language except in Iran and points east. Two men played a decisive role in the formation of this new empire and the culture which went with it. Both bore the titles of caliph, from the Arabic khalifa, originally successor of the prophet, and commander of the faithful. The first was Umar ibn al-Khattab, called Umar the First, who reigned from 634 to 644, and the other, Abdul Malik the Umayyad, 685 to 705. The achievements of both these men were fundamental to the development of the Islamic Golden Age. Umar was the man who directed the first wave of conquests, and he and the small group of advisers who surrounded him impressed their idea on the leaders and the armies who answered their call to arms. The armies of the conquest were not a collection of migrating tribes and peoples, driving their ragged goats and camels into the prosperous and well-tended lands of the Fertile Crescent. They were rather groups of fighting men, assembled into armies in Medina, the political capital of the caliphate at this stage, and led by commanders appointed by Umar and his colleagues. We can debate forever the motivation of the men who joined these campaigns, and whether you believe they were inspired by deep religious conviction or by desire for riches and booty, probably says more about your own values and attitudes than it does about the motivations of the men of the 7th century. Many of them certainly saw no contradiction between serving God and his prophet and becoming rich. Indeed, the plunder which they seized from their enemies was generally seen as a sure sign of God's blessing. Narratives and poetry from this period show a clear mindset which was typical of at least some of the warriors. They contrasted their ragged clothes and Spartan lifestyles with the luxurious fabrics and palaces of their opponents. They saw themselves as an army of free individuals, while their enemies were servile, ruled by tyrants, and chained together to stop them fleeing the battlefield. And at least after the first successes, they saw no limitations to their conquests. The whole world could be raided and conquered in the name of God and his prophet. So Islam was spread by the sword, by naked military power. Or was it? When we look more closely, we can see that the story is more complex, and much of the credit for this must go to Umar and his circle. To understand this, we must realise that the political conquest and conversion to Islam were two very separate processes with two different dynamics. Conquest, as we have seen, was swift, over and accomplished in a few decades. It was also, at least in some of the great battles, Yarmouk in Syria, Qadisiyah in Iraq, bloody and violent. The conversion of the majority of the population of the conquered lands to Islam took centuries and was an almost entirely peaceful process. Following on ideas formulated by the Prophet, Umar accepted that Christian and Jewish populations of the lands the Muslims conquered should be treated as people of the sacred book, since they were both scriptural religions. They should be allowed to retain their lives, possessions, their lands and their religious buildings and observances in exchange for the acceptance of Muslim sovereignty and the paying of a poll tax. The Zoroastrians of Iran were accepted for pragmatic reasons as people of the book. This was the so-called Covenant of Umar, which allowed the non-Muslims of the new empire a measure of freedom and cultural identity. It also meant that they were prepared, except for certain elite Christian groups who left for Constantinople or Italy, to accept Muslim rule. Astonishingly, among the many civil wars and conflicts which disturbed the peace of the Middle East during the early Muslim centuries, there were virtually no anti-Muslim revolts by the conquered people, no attempt to overthrow Islamic rule. So we can say that Islam was not spread by the sword, but without the sword, it would not have spread, at least not with the speed that it did. Umar's vision went further than the development of a modus vivendi with the non-Muslim majority. He also made decisions about the nature of Muslim rule. When the Germanic invaders of the 5th and 6th century put an end to Roman rule in the West, they settled throughout the towns and countryside, establishing themselves as landowners and living on the incomes and produce of their estates. Over a period of time, they adopted the Christian religion of the people they had conquered, and, at least in France, Spain, and Italy, the late Latin that their subjects spoke and wrote. There was no need for government or any complex system of taxation to maintain this simple system. There is no reason to think that Umar had any knowledge of what had happened in the West, but he is said to have been aware that there was a danger that the Muslims would lose their religious and cultural identity amongst the masses of people over whom they now ruled. So instead of allowing the members of the victorious army to live where they wanted to, he made a conscious decision that they were to be settled in garrison towns, close to but separated from the local populations. The three new Muslim towns where we can observe these processes most clearly are Kufa, southeast of Baghdad, itself a Muslim new town of a later period, Basra, at the head of the Gulf, and Fustat, Old Cairo. Here they were to live a Muslim existence, ready to confront any local resistance and preparing for further campaigns. But what were they to live off? Most of the men who settled in the new cities came from Bedouin backgrounds. They had survived by grazing their sheep and camels in the harsh deserts of Arabia, wandering through its desolate landscapes in search of water and grass. This was clearly incompatible with settled urban life, yet they could not be left without any means of subsistence. They had to eat and feed and clothe the families who now came to join them. Umar's solution was to pay them salaries, or perhaps pensions would be a better word. These pensions were to be paid in coined money, gold dinars in Syria and Egypt, silver dirhams in Iraq and Iran, both forms of coin which had been used by the previous rulers. And of course the money for these payments had to be collected, accounted for, and distributed to those entitled to receive them. The new Muslim rulers had no alternative but to use the services of the collectors and accountants who'd worked for the old, conquered empires. Now, this may seem like a rather dull piece of administrative history, but in fact its results were profound. Alone of all the areas that had been part of the Roman Empire, the Islamic world preserved a structure of general public taxation, collected by a government and distributed to those who were entitled in regular payments. But it also resulted in the continuance of a secular, and in many cases non-Muslim, literate and numerate elite. It was these bureaucrats, above all, who were responsible for generating and maintaining the intellectual culture we are celebrating in these essays. If Umar and his group had allowed members of the Arab armies to settle the land, the story would have been very different. But these bureaucrats and the files and accounting systems they used were, naturally, continued in the language they'd always used, Greek in the West and Middle Persian or Pahlavi in Iraq and Iran. This is where the second of our leading figures comes in. Abdul Malik came to power after a long civil war in the Muslim community. In order to prevent this sort of fragmentation occurring again, he decided to create a uniform administration throughout his domains. And he decided that the language of this uniform administration should be not Greek or Persian, but Arabic. This was a decision with momentous consequences. All Muslims had accepted that Arabic was the language of Quran, the language in which God had communicated his message to mankind. Now it was to be the language of government, the language of taxpaying. Not only that, but it was to be the language of coinage as well. Up to this time, Muslim rulers had used coins inherited from the old empires or minted their own in imitation of these. After a series of experiments with images of caliphs after the manner of Roman emperors, Abdul Malik decided to sweep all this away. Muslim coins now carried only writing, Arabic writing, with the names of rulers, dates, and places of minting. All the inhabitants of the caliphate, Muslim and non-Muslim, Arab and non-Arab, were now exposed to Arabic script and Arabic writing in their daily life. And this change had a profound effect on the educated administrators and bureaucrats who ran the new system. Men who had worked in Greek or Middle Persian or Coptic in Egypt now had to learn Arabic or lose their jobs. In the next generation, growing up in the first decades of the 8th century, no one went to school to learn Greek or Middle Persian anymore because there were no jobs in Greek and Middle Persian. To get a decent civil service position, you had to be able to function in Arabic. Middle Persian was used only by those who clung to the old Zoroastrian religion, and it had probably ceased to be a spoken language by the year 900. Greek and Coptic retreated to the cloister and the religious liturgy. Though even here things were changing. By the late 8th century, the Greek Orthodox churches in Syria were using Arabic, not Greek, in their worship. Such were the building bricks of the linguistic and intellectual structures which gave rise to the Arabic-Muslim cultures of the Golden Age. Umar's decisions, whether consciously or unconsciously, had ensured that the Muslims would retain their religious identity and that there would be a state structure which employed a class of literate and numerate bureaucrats. Abdul Malik's reforms ensured that these civil servants would operate exclusively in Arabic. As Greek and Middle Persian retreated, so Arabic came to dominate, not just as the language of religious discourse, but the language of power, government, and soon the language of everyday life. And it was precisely among these bureaucrats that Arabic secular literature, whether in prose narratives, philosophy, science, or poetry, emerges. Whether as writers or patrons, or both, it was they who created the culture we shall be discussing in the essays which follow. But without the leadership and the particular decisions of Umar and Abdul Malik, this environment would have been very, very different, almost certainly not Arabic, and possibly not Muslim either.